Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for July 1st, 2011. I'm Stuart Wills. This week, social modifications of memory, looking back at the space shuttle, and exploring the mathematics of terrorism. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
It's happened to all of us at one time or another. The impact of peer pressure or social norms modifies our perception of events, even down to our memories of the past. This very human tendency, though, can have big implications in arenas such as the courtroom, where the stakes are high and where eyewitness testimony is known to be particularly subject to post hoc modification. In a paper published in Science this week, Micah Adelson and colleagues look at how this phenomenon of socially constructed memory conformity plays out in the brain. The team found that the long-term alteration of firmly held memories by social influence is marked by activity in a highly specific brain region. Adelson spoke with me about the work from his office at the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel.
I would say that our memory is surprisingly susceptible to social influences, even in everyday situations like talking to a neighbor, a group of friends. And in our study, we try to create a paradigm that can allow us to explore this brain activity while such memory alterations occur. And what we find is heightened coactivation in two brain regions, the hippocampus and the amygdala. And we find that this observes long-term memory change that's induced by social pressure and conformity.
All right, well, maybe you could set the stage for us a bit. We're looking, as you suggest, at sort of this phenomenon of long-term memory conformity. How exactly, what are some of the ways that manifests itself in our lives?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think that we humans are very social animals, and we've evolved to take social information very seriously. We're also constantly exposed to social influence in our day-to-day lives, and I think it's important that we understand how this can affect us. For example, reminiscing with a friend about life periods like college travel and things like that can definitely influence what we remember. And we know, for example, that our political views and consumer habits are heavily influenced by our social surroundings. In many cultures, for example, the way that people remember periods of government is often driven by the collective memory of life under that government. And this is strongly influenced by the social environment, especially in Western cultures with well-developed media. Memory conformity can also create problems. Law and policymakers may not always fully understand this phenomenon, and thus they may not necessarily take it into account. The effectiveness of the social pressure in altering memory, together with the sheer amount of social interactions that we have undergo every day, can make memory conformity a possible source for miscarriage of justice. And studies have shown that in most cases, witnesses to a crime are not alone in the crime scene. They're usually more than one witness, and they often discuss the crime details with each other before testifying. And this can definitely have influence on court cases. And in this context, it's also important to differentiate between two kinds of conformity. Sometimes when we are confronted by group pressure, in order to not be the outsider, people might actually claim to abide by information which they do not believe in. And I think we all felt this a little bit on our own flesh. For example, let's say you're in a dinner party at your friend's house and they're talking about your favorite politician and you realize that they really hate him. But when they ask your opinion, you might shrug your shoulders and say, you're probably right, he's not very charismatic. Well, actually, you don't really believe this, and in election time, you might actually vote for him. And this is called conforming publicly. And it will only last as long as there's social pressure to conform. However, more importantly, group pressure can actually trigger a real change in memory, and that's long-lasting. And this is what's called private conformity, and this process is what we're more interested in.
And I guess your team wanted to look at how these two different kinds of conformity might reflect different brain processes. How did you actually set that up?
Well, actually, one of the most significant challenges that we faced in this experiment was to create a protocol that could induce real-life social pressure under a controlled scientific setting while scanning participants' brain in functional magnetic imaging. And what we did is we created a four-phase protocol. Initially, the participants viewed a movie in small social groups, and they were subsequently individually asked about the film, and they provided a confidence level. 4 days later, the participants performed the same test again in the fMRI scanner, but this time they were exposed to fake answers that were supposedly given by their fellow group members. And on a subset of these questions, in which we initially identified that the participants had a strong, correct memory, only on these questions did we attempt to induce conformity and have the participants change their correct answer to an incorrect one, just because this incorrect answer was endorsed by the group. Now, this is not enough because we wanted to know when conforming actually induced long-lasting memory change and not just behavioral compliance. So we tested the subject one last time after removing the social pressure, and we assumed that if the subject still maintained their incorrect answer, even in the absence of social pressure and a week after the manipulation, this indicates that their individual memory was actually altered.
So you had a protocol where you could essentially test, if I'm understanding correctly, whether we were dealing with public or private conformity. And then you attempted to correlate this with the brain function using fMRI or functional magnetic resonance imaging. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, absolutely.
And what did you find in all of this?
Well, interestingly, we found that on almost 70% of the cases, participants conformed to the group and gave incorrect answers, although you have to remember that initially they were rather confident about their correct answer. In 40% of these cases, this error remained as a long-lasting memory. And our fMRI results show that if we look at the brain activations of participants while under the social pressure, we can distinguish between private and public conformity, even when behaviorally there's no difference between the two. So we can tell when long-lasting memory change will ensue because such memory change will be subserved by joint activation in two brain regions, the amygdala and the hippocampus. And we know the hippocampus is an important part of memory processing in the brain, and the amygdala is a core component of social and emotional processing. And we find that the way that these two regions interact determines if social influence will result in long-lasting memory change. And our research suggests that the brain has evolved to deal with the social world around us in a unique way, because this hippocampal-amygdala joint activation wasn't evident when memory was altered via non-social influence.
Well, you know, maybe it's my imagination, but it seems that lately we've been seeing a lot of studies that highlight the role of the amygdala. I mean, it seems every time we turn around, this brain area is important in some other aspect of human behavior.
Well, I think that's a good question. And indeed, the amygdala has been the focus of a lot of research lately. And I think this is probably because it's part of a very basic and primary system in evolution that in lower animals played a critical role in most activities. As we've evolved, we may rely less on this limbic emotional system than our predecessors, but it still has a strong impact on many different processes. And in our study, the amygdala probably plays a critical role because it's perfectly situated, both anatomically and functionally, between the emotional, social, and memory processing systems in the brain. And we think that the amygdala activity may be needed for some types of memories to give them approval to be uploaded to the memory bank. So social reinforcement can act on the amygdala to persuade our brains to replace a strong memory with a different one. And this can make sense on evolutionary level because information given by a group can hold high validity, and it may be adaptive to incorporate it into our own storage.
Okay, so what is next in your group and in the field for this kind of research?
Well, as I said, I think that humans have evolved to be very social animals, and this has helped form the way we think and remember and act and probably our unique brain development as well. And I think we're just now starting to understand these processes on a neurobiological level. So there's a lot of work to be done in the field of social neuroscience in the next few years, and I think we can explore how the social brain influences other brain processes.
Micah Adelson, thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Micah Adelson is the lead author of a new paper in Science on the brain substrates of socially induced memory errors. Next week, if all goes according to plan, the space shuttle Atlantis will lift off from its Florida launch pad. It's a very special mission, because it will mark the last flight of the space shuttle and the end of NASA's shuttle program, a fixture on the spaceflight scene for the last 30 years. In a News Focus article in this week's Science, writer Dan Charles looks back at the program, and especially at its scientific component. Here's Dan Charles.
The shuttle was a really interesting platform that scientists could try to use. It wasn't built for science, but it was kind of a jack of all trades that turned out to be useful. Whether it was worth the money is the question people always turn to, and that, I think, people would have to honestly say it wasn't worth the money just for the science. It had to be justified some other way.
It's interesting you use the term jack of all trade. In part of your story, you refer to the shuttle as a space-going Swiss Army knife, which I sort of liked. What did you mean by that metaphor?
Well, they used it for a lot of things. And some things, they used it because it was there, but it wasn't really built for that. For instance, you know, the microgravity experiments, the kind of experiments that you could do on the shuttle because it could go up into space in relative weightlessness and then come back down again. So you could put experiments on the shuttle that could just examine, so what happens to something? It's a chemical reaction, a plant, a human body. What happens to it if you put it in this situation where the effects of gravity can't be, you know, observed or felt? Well, it turned out you could do that, but the shuttle had certain problems, you know, for that kind of experiment. It wasn't truly zero gravity. It had to maneuver to do various things. Even the astronauts walking around in the shuttle would sort of jitter the experiments a bit. So if you really wanted to do these microgravity experiments, you had to actually put something outside the shuttle, which some people did sometimes. So it did that. It launched satellites. It conducted repair missions.
Yeah, I guess to many of us, the shuttle's most important contribution to science was really sort of more of an engineering achievement, putting a pair of eyeglasses, if you will, on the Hubble Space Telescope.
Right. Well, that was certainly the most spectacular thing when you think about it. They're up there in space. They're traveling thousands of miles an hour. They're spinning around the globe every 90 minutes. They're in weightlessness in these spacesuits, and they're fiddling with this billion-dollar instrument and amazingly successfully fixing it.
Well, you know, you touched on the realm of more experimental science. Could you go in a little bit more about some of the successes and maybe some of the shortfalls in these kinds of experiments over the shuttle's long tenure?
It was an interesting thing. When you put the shuttle up there, they said, oh, let's do science on the shuttle. But this was a new kind of platform. It hadn't existed before. And so early on, people didn't really know, what is it good for, really? What kind of experiments make sense? And so they came in all different varieties, from the almost silly, put a colony of honeybees up there and see if their honeycomb is still hexagonal. It was. To the very sophisticated, let's grow thin film semiconductors in space, maybe, you know, in the ultra pure environment of the vacuum you can create behind a disk going through space in low Earth orbit, we can, you know, do things we couldn't do on Earth, or grow protein crystals, or just examine the way a plant maybe produces lignin. Maybe without gravity, it doesn't produce lignin because it doesn't need to, you know, be structurally rigid to stand up straight. All kinds of things. So some of them turned out better than others. You know, I think it's very difficult because there's so many different areas of science and nobody knows each one, and there's all kinds of parochial interests. It's very difficult to kind of come to some sort of conclusion and say, what was the really good science that was done on shuttle? And I think as a gross generalization, some of the studies that have been done kind of come to the conclusion, yes, there was lots of interesting work done on shuttle. Was there any path-breaking achievement? Was there any landmark discovery? Probably not so far. I mean, the really big things it did was, you know, launch the big observatories, which, honestly, you could have done another way.
Well, will this last mission next week include any science component?
There's a little bit of science. For years now, there has not been really very much science on the shuttle. Ever since Columbia disintegrated on reentry in 2003. That was the final mission of so-called Space Lab, the modules inside the cargo bay where scientists could actually work. Ever since, the shuttle has really been a transport vehicle to take things to the space station. So there hasn't been much in the way of science. But just as in the early days before Space Lab ever flew, there's still little experiments that get tucked away in these things they call lockers in the mid-deck, the area where the astronauts sleep. And, yeah, you know, on this mission, there's, for instance, an experiment involving genetically engineered salmonella bacteria, which have been altered and attenuated so that they actually are supposed to function as a vaccine against a different disease. And previous experiments apparently showed that the wild type of salmonella is more virulent in space for whatever reason, not sure. So the idea is maybe these vaccine versions of salmonella might behave differently in space too. So, yep, they're going to send them up and see.
I guess, though, looking at the history, the shuttle hasn't always been every scientist's dream platform.
No, there's been a lot of emotions about the shuttle. And there were scientists who wanted to put experiments on the shuttle who were frustrated because it never flew as often as NASA promised. But there were also scientists who really, you know, frankly, despise the shuttle, who think it's an expression of kind of an irrational, impractical urge to put humans in space that is just an enormous waste of money. As far as they're concerned, the shuttle has actually gotten in the way of true space exploration that could have been done with scientific instruments, with robots, much more cheaply. So yeah, there are scientists out there who really, you know, think the shuttle was not a good thing for science.
Dan Charles, thanks very much for chatting with me today.
It's a pleasure being here.
Dan Charles takes a backward glance at the science of the space shuttle in a news focus in this week's issue. You can find it online, along with a timeline of shuttle science, at www.sciencemag.org. Can the inherently messy phenomena of war, insurgency, and terrorism follow mathematical laws? A new paper in Science suggests that in one respect, the answer may be yes. Neil Johnson and colleagues examined data from the recent wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, as well as on global terrorist attacks over a period of more than four decades. They found a surprisingly regular relationship across geographies and insurgencies between the timing of the first two fatalities within a given region in an insurgency and the subsequent escalation rate for fatal attacks in the same area. And the team sees analogies between the pattern of adaptation and counteradaptation in the escalation of hostilities and one popular arms race metaphor cited in evolutionary biology. Lead author Neil Johnson spoke with me about the paper from his office at the University of Miami.
We were trying to see if there's some common way in which wars and terrorist campaigns escalate over time, and if there's something that might provide us with some kind of new, almost like lens of looking at how the two sides play out the day-to-day kind of adaptation and counter-adaptation that goes into the escalation of war and terrorist activities and terrorist campaigns.
And to look at that, you looked at quite an interesting data set. You were looking at both the comparatively recent experience in Afghanistan and Iraq and the larger history of global terrorism since 1968. Can you tell me a little bit more about the data sources you actually tapped?
Yeah, we tapped data sources that are freely available for public use. And, a lot of work has gone into these individual data sources, so they're sort of state-of-the-art in terms of their reliability. The first, as you mentioned, for Afghanistan and Iraq was the public website iCasualties.org. That lists the fatalities of coalition military in Operation Enduring Freedom, the Afghanistan war from 2001 onwards, and also Operation Iraqi Freedom, the Iraq War from 2003 onwards. So that gave us detailed information about military casualties and hence the fatalities inflicted by the insurgency on the coalition military. The terrorism data sets were from a database called the Morrill Institute Prevention of Terrorism database, and that was originally analyzed by Aaron Clauset, University of Colorado, and we used those data and analyses to compare to Iraq and Afghanistan and also to suicide bombing campaigns, and we chose Hezbollah and Pakistan militants taken from the website from University of Chicago, Robert Pape, which is the Chicago Project on Security and Terrorism.
So what did you do with all of these data?
Right, so we were particularly interested in the following question. Might it be that when we consider different conflicts and even terrorism campaigns, that since you've got essentially one side, an insurgency or a terrorist group, trying to adapt to inflict fatalities on the other side, might we see something along the lines of what you see when people in other human group activity or individual activity of repeating tasks from pencil mazes through to shipbuilding and manufacturing, etc., where the time between successive events decreases as the conflict would evolve, but it decreases in a particular mathematical way called a progress curve. And we were particularly interested if that gave us then some kind of insight into almost like how these insurgent groups or terrorist groups are actually evolving over time and adapting to what, say, the coalition military are themselves doing.
So in a sense, you were taking what might be viewed as almost a phenomenon that is too messy and complicated to understand and trying to pull out a certain statistical relationship.
That's right. I think when we all think of conflict and terrorism, I mean, these are horribly chaotic, disordered types of activities. And when you listen to their numbers reported on the news and the media, it just sounds like some random collection of numbers. And we wanted to look behind these numbers to see if there is actually some kind of almost pattern or common behavior across all these different arenas, which are, you know, very different geographies, very different people, very different motivations. Maybe it's just the way in which human groups go about this kind of activity, this violent activity.
Well, the actual statistical analysis in your paper is pretty sophisticated, but I wonder if you could give us kind of a general idea of the high points, the main sorts of patterns of these kinds that emerge from the data and some of what you think it might mean.
Yes, just to give a kind of example of what, from everyday experience, of what kind of waiting times are between events. Imagine we stand at some kind of bus stop and we wait for successive buses. Since they're coming according to some kind of timetable, they'll come at regular intervals. That's one kind of extreme. The other kind of extreme is either the time it takes for me to wait for a roll of a six of a dice. If I keep rolling a dice, how long do I have to wait? Well, those two types of waiting time appear in many different realms of human everyday experience. But the mathematical form that we found for events, for fatal days, for fatal fatalities inflicted by insurgents and terrorist groups, do not follow either of those two patterns. Instead, they follow the same pattern that you get when an individual, for example, or a group are trying to carry out successive repetitions of some particular tricky task. So it's well known from surgery that a team of surgeons, every time they do a particular task, I mean, they get slightly better at it, but the task itself may actually, you know, slightly different every time. And so they gradually improve the time it takes them to complete the task. And that gives something called a progress curve. Well, this is exactly what we found for the insurgency and also the terrorism. It's as though the insurgent and terrorist groups are trying to carry out the task of inflicting a fatality against the coalition military over time, and they're gradually getting better at it, and it follows exactly that mathematical relation called this progress curve.
And I think the parameters you were actually looking at were the timing of the first 2 days of fatalities and the escalation rate, essentially the how rapidly violence escalated?
Yes, and this is the really interesting aspect, very intriguing aspect of this particular mathematical form that we found. It turns out that to get the time between, say, the 50th fatal attack and the 51st, all you need to know is the time between the first two events that ever happened and this particular value for the escalation rate. The fascinating thing is that if you compare then different provinces, for example, in Afghanistan and even the ones in Iraq, there's a very subtle but clear relationship between these time between the first two events and the escalation rate for all these different provinces. Now, on the one hand, you might think, well, if all the provinces are part of the same war, they should have the same values. Well, that doesn't happen. On the other hand, you might also think, well, these provinces, probably there are different insurgent groups in each province, so they should have no relation to each other. But that also doesn't happen. Instead, there's this very strong linear relationship, this straight line relationship between the values of the time between the first two attacks in any province and the escalation rate in any province.
So there's clearly something going on here that's kind of fundamental in sort of the terms you described earlier about, you know, how rapidly these groups are becoming expert in these kinds of violence. But you also tie this in your paper to the so-called Red Queen hypothesis from evolutionary biology. I was wondering if you could just quickly touch on that.
Yeah, so it's a common analogy in evolutionary biology that different species compete with each other in a similar way to the Red Queen and Lewis Carroll's book, Through the Looking Glass. And there, the Red Queen famously states that, you know, it takes all the running that you can do to keep in the same place. In other words, both species are trying to get ahead, and of course, with each time one gets ahead, the other one gets ahead as well, and so they basically both stay still with respect to each other. So I've always been intrigued by that, and that actual narrative in association with, say, human conflict. But what we found is something really quite interesting that I think might eventually feed back into the evolutionary biology side. What we find is that if you think about it, in a race, even if both sides are almost equally fast, you wouldn't have the situation where they're both neck and neck all the time. On average, they might be neck and neck. But if you looked at it over time, from day to day or moment to moment in a race, in the case of the Red Queen, you'd see the Red Queen pull ahead and then maybe fall behind and then maybe pull further ahead and then get, you know, it's almost like one step forward, two steps back. And it's exactly that dynamics. It's exactly that sporadic kind of change in the lead of the Red Queen that we find explains then or gives rise to then these patterns of the progress curve for particular provinces.
Well, do you think the results in your paper might have any application in real-world counterinsurgency or counterterrorism?
Yes, I think that, you know, anything you can do to understand better how things play out on the short, you know, day-to-day and week-to-week timescale has got to be good for planning and also and training and also assessing progress, you know, maybe ultimately knowing what the right number is for boots on the ground. But we also, my co-worker and I, Brian Tivnan, we also believe that this could be applied to other types of insurgency, almost cyber insurgency. I mean, there's no reason that these attacks needed to be on the ground. They could be in cyberspace. So I do see this as a very, it's kind of a broad brush way of seeing how this escalation of attacks by human groups, kind of hidden human groups on some larger incumbent group play out.
Neil Johnson, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Neil Johnson is lead author of a paper on patterns of escalation in insurgent and terrorist activity. Finally today, David Grimm, the online news editor of Science, is here to share a few stories that recently appeared on our daily news site. Well, Dave, penguins, exomoons, and LSD sounds like an unbeatable combination
to
me.
It is a very interesting mix of stories this week.
First, tell me why penguins are afraid of the dark.
Well, that was the going idea anyways. Scientists have been looking at two species of penguins in Antarctica, and these species are known as Adelie and Emperor penguins. And what's interesting about these penguins is they sort of act like daily commuters. They're up at the crack of dawn, they're out in the water, they're trying to catch krill and fish, and when dusk comes, they come back home, they sleep through the night. What's unusual about this behavior is that the food that these penguins die on is actually easiest to catch after dark. It tends to be closest to the surface. So the question is, why are these penguins sleeping the night away when they could be a lot more productive hunting-wise if they try to catch these animals at night? And researchers have sort of wondered, well, not are penguins afraid of the dark, but maybe they can't see very well in the dark. Maybe there is something poor about their nighttime vision.
And is there?
Well, it turns out there's not. In this new study, a group of researchers actually went out in the field and they outfitted a group of about 65 of the Adelie penguins with these time depth recorders. And these are little devices that measure how deep the penguins swim and also how dark it is where they swim. And what they found was that the Adelie penguins tend to hunt prey at about 50 to 100 meters below the surface. And the water is actually pretty dark down there. It's akin to early night. And the penguins can actually even go farther down than this into deeper waters that are almost pitch black and hunt just as effectively. So what does all this mean? Well, all this means is that the penguins can see very effectively in the dark. So it's not their lack of nighttime vision that's preventing them from going out at night and hunting.
Okay, well, if it's not the night vision, what is it?
Well, the researchers think it has everything to do with predation. There are two big penguin killers, or what the researchers think are penguin killers, in the Antarctic. One is leopard seals, and the other is killer whales. Leopard seals actually tend to rest at midday, so they're less likely to kill penguins during this time, and that's why the researchers think penguins are doing a lot of their hunting during the day. And there's actually no direct evidence that killer whales are actually killing these penguins, but there is anecdotal evidence that they can and that they do kill other penguin species in other parts of the Antarctic. So all this together suggests that the penguins may actually be afraid of the dark, not because they can't see in it, but because they're afraid of getting killed by a predator.
So they'd rather eat a little less than be eaten themselves.
Exactly. And actually, the predation is apparently such a concern for them that they even have altered their migration patterns. They go way out of their way when they're migrating in the Antarctic summer. Instead of sticking to the closest and richest waters for food, they swim north to far less productive waters. And a lot of them die during this journey, but they're willing to make the journey because it's actually, in the long run, a lot safer for them than sticking around in places where they could get killed by a predator.
So kind of interesting that fear plays such a big role here.
Exactly.
And next, an argument for life on moons outside of our solar system.
Right, Stuart, this next story is all about trying to find alien life. And what astronomers have been doing so far is they've been looking for what's called exoplanets. These are planets that are in solar systems beyond our own. And they've actually racked up a fair number of these planets, a few hundred so far, actually. But the problem with most of these planets is very few of them, if any of them, have been Earth-like. A lot of them tend to be what's called gas giants, which are these giant planets the size of Jupiter and Saturn. These are very hot planets. They tend to be very close to their parent stars. They're very gaseous. They're not very good places for life. Well, in this new study, astronomers say, well, maybe those planets are not good for life, but maybe they have moons orbiting them that resemble our planet. And if these planets are orbiting their sun about the same distance that Earth is orbiting our sun, perhaps their moons could support life.
Well, how on earth do you actually establish such a thing?
Well, we obviously can't go visit. So what researchers do, or at least what they did in this study, was they constructed some computer models. They actually made a computer model of about 12,000 hypothetical planets that were about the size of Earth. The idea is that these planets would exist perhaps in an early solar system, and they would be captured by the gravity of a gas giant. And what happens, according to the simulations, is a lot of these planets start orbiting the gas giant, but over the course of hundreds of thousands of years, half of them crash into the gas giants, or they're spat out of orbit, so they don't meet very good fates. But the other half tend to evolve steady orbits, which allow them to develop stable climates over billions of years, and stable climates are important for harboring life.
Well, it's interesting, but it sounds a bit speculative, too.
Well, exactly. And not only is it speculative, but even if all these things go right, the actual fraction of gas giants that would be harboring an Earth-like planet, or at least a planet habitable towards life, is actually pretty low. The team estimates that only about 10% of the gas giants in a habitable zone would capture an Earth-like exomoon. And if only about 50% of those move into stable orbits and all these other factors, they estimate that of the roughly 300 or so gas giant planets that have been found so far, only about a dozen might harbor habitable moons. But still, that's a dozen potential Earths out there.
Well, does anybody have any thoughts about just what kind of life we're talking about on these exomoons?
Well, it's a good question. And one of the other problems with gas giants is they tend to have very strong radiation belts. And you can imagine if you're a moon orbiting that gas giant and you're being blasted with radiation, that's not going to be a very good environment for life. But what the researchers say in this study is that water and solid dirt block a lot of this radiation, or at least they would block a lot of this radiation. So there's a possibility for life perhaps underground or undersea. So again, there's a lot of caveats here, but it does sort of expand the realm of places that we might find life beyond our solar system.
And finally, the newest headache remedy, LSD.
Right. Well, it's kind of an unexpected headache remedy. You wouldn't think to turn to a psychedelic drug to cure your headaches, but there's a type of headache it appears to be very effective against. And this is a type of headache called cluster headaches. Now, for anybody that's had these are incredibly agonizing headaches. Patients describe the feeling of somebody trying to pull their eyes out for hours. This is a very unpleasant headache. In fact, it's often referred to as a suicide headache because it's so unpleasant. Patients almost want to kill themselves. There have been a few treatments that have been available in the past. Some studies have showed that inhaling pure oxygen seems to help. Other types of drugs that block calcium channels also seem to help. And some anecdotal reports have suggested that psychedelic drugs like LSD and psilocybin may also confer some benefits, but they haven't been scientifically tested up until now.
So what was the scientific test applied here?
Well, the researchers in this study didn't actually use LSD. They used an analog called 2-bromo-LSD, which is highly related to LSD, but it doesn't have the hallucinogenic properties.
Oh, well.
That takes a little bit of the fun out of it. But what they did was they recruited 6 people that had these cluster headaches. They gave them this LSD analog once every 5 days for a total of about 3 doses. And what happened was that all patients reported a reduction in the frequency of their headaches, and 5 patients reported having no headaches for months afterwards. In fact, some of them are still reporting significant relief more than a year after the study was completed.
Well, is 6 patients really enough to say something like this?
Well, that's the problem. It's promising, and it's good to test these things that were only sort of suspected anecdotally before. But one of the problems with this trial is that there were really no controls. It was not a blinded study, as researchers like to say. In other words, these patients knew they were getting a treatment. There was no placebo group. In fact, a study that had tested the effect of pure oxygen had shown that about 20% of the patients actually didn't get pure oxygen. They just got basically just regular air. And even they reported some relief. So it's possible that some of this effect is due to the placebo group. The scientists have founded a company based on their idea, though, and obviously they are going to keep on testing this to hopefully show that this LSD analog does have efficacy against these very severe headaches.
Okay, Dave, what other stories are you looking into on the news site?
Well, Stuart, for Science Now, we've got a story about why happy orangutans live longer. Also a story about how an organ transplant drug may reverse premature aging. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a new story about a controversial new prize that's been offered by a scientist / former politician to promote research into the origin of life and what his ulterior motive is for offering this prize. Also a story about the latest battle over stem cell research in the U.S. What's happening in the courts over efforts to ban federal funding for stem cell research. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science. This week's chat is about the effect of climate change on wildfires. Is global warming driving an increase in wildfires around the world? So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that wraps up the July 1st, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast. Thanks to Andrew Green for his help with this week's show. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Stuart Wills. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.